Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Welcome to the Chasing Giants podcast, episode 286, airing on August 17th, 2025. Don Higgins, how are we doing today?
Good. How are you, Terry?
I'm doing really well. It's still really hot where we're at. We've had this wet spring all summer, but we've had a dry spell here. And man, I really wish we would get one of these rains come through to push these bean pods out. I'm really struggling with how dry it has been right when that soybean plant needs to push out those beans.
Yeah, the soybeans definitely need a rain sometime here between now and the first week or so of September, depending on the variety of soybeans. But, I keep going back with soybeans. I'll never forget the fall of 2012. That's the fall of the terrible drought. And that's the year I went to Alaska. And I went to Alaska in the first of September. Everything was dry as could be. I mean, we didn't get hardly any rain all summer. And we got a fantastic crop out of them soybeans as well. The pods were filled out and everything. So a late rain can do wonders for a soybean crop. Now the corn crop is kind of finishing out right now, and we could definitely use a rain here immediately. A couple inches would be great to, help fill out that corn crop, but it doesn't look like we're going to get it anytime soon.
So we talked about it last week. I sent some corn samples from my NutriCrave plot and the test plots back. David Heath from FAE left my farm and went to your farm to set up the mulching heads. And did you see the message back from Dwayne on the bushels per acre? He estimated the NutriCrave on my place. The NutriCrave was at 252 bushels an acre is what he estimated based on population and the size of the ear.
Yeah, and the one of the test varieties was what? It was over 200, but
213.
It didn't match the NutriCrave. So, it's hard to say in a food plot situation what you really got, just because typically there's deer damage and you just don't get the yield that you would on an ag field. You can go out there and pick a real nice ear and get an estimate of what you could produce in an ag field. Yeah. But that goes for any variety of corn, really. So
we're definitely not saying we're just saying the potential that's there. You would need acres of this to run, your combine across to get a true measurement, but that's how big of ears that we're getting off of just food plot corn. It's pretty impressive.
Well, there was two years ago, there was a farmer, Greg Mills from here in Illinois, grew some NutriCrave. And I mean, he's a production ag farmer. I mean, he knows what he's doing. And he sent us a photo of where he'd peeled the husk back for some ears that were still on the stalk and everything. And it was either 308 or 306 that he estimated the yield was on that plot. And the same year, we had one in Iowa, and that was a farmer too, a Mitch Finke, guy I got my John Deere planter from, came to my master class. And I think his was 306 or 308. They were both really close together, and I can't remember which one was which, but there was two the same year planted by farmers that know what they're doing, and both were over 300 bushel an acre.
I think it's funny that we look back when we first started, saying we were going to bring NutriCrave out, we actually thought the yield was going to be a little bit lighter than ag corn. But, so far everything we've seen is it'll hold right to it. It's just, it's a little bit more finicky than soybeans or clover or other food plot blends. It's grown corn's a little tougher.
Yeah. And, in most situations, it's probably with today's hybrids, it's probably going to lag back a little. But you can get it to yield right up there. And I forget, Jeremy Sluter out in Kansas had some they grew last year for deer corn out that way. And I forget what the yield was, but I think it was on irrigated acres. The other thing is, it seems like when the yield is higher, the nutrient content is higher. So if that plant struggles somehow, it struggles to put on yield due to the weather or whatever, it's also going to struggle a little bit with the nutrient content. And when you get these big yields, like we're going to see this year in our plots, the nutrient content seems to be higher. And I'm kind of anxious to get those grain samples sent in for tests, for analysis, to see exactly if that holds true again this year, because we got a really good corn crop. I'd just like to see about 2 inches of rain this week to just finish it out.
Yeah, but we're not doing those tissue analysis until they dry down. We made a social media post last week about, you know, these guys that are going out and doing tissue analysis of corn kernels at this point. They're not getting what we need out of this. So much changes as the plant dries down. Now, you could do green leaf matter tissue analysis. Like if a guy was dairy farmers who use our NutriCrave for cutting silage, that's okay. I mean, you're getting a sample there, but not on the grain.
Yeah, and we've seen multiple tests being done this summer. There's a gentleman in Kentucky that's testing about 4 different varieties of corn, and NutriCrave being one of them. And I think he knows what he's doing, and I think he's doing a fair test. We've seen another one out of Michigan that was nothing but I'm not sure what to call it. I'd call it a hammer job, I guess. They was trying to hammer NutriCrave. I think the test was designed. I think they knew NutriCrave was going to fail before they ever put the seed in the ground because they wanted it to.
Yeah. Anyway, there's always going to be those people. We get it. But yeah, we're excited. That 2 inches of rain that you talk about, let's talk about fall plots just a little bit. We're on that window. This episode's going to air on August 17th, so we're getting into that third week of August. Most of the areas have been dry for the last couple of weeks, even though we've had a wet spring, wet summer. We've gotten showers. It's been a little dry here the last couple of weeks. Let's just address this because so many people, I bet I got 3 texts today asking with rain in the forecast next week. So that's August. That would be, say, August 20th through 25th. If they have rain in the forecast and their mark based on planting date should be September 1st, do they go ahead and cheat it by 7 days and go ahead and plant in front of this rain? Or do you wait and go a little bit later hoping you get another round?
Well, my suggestion, my opinion, and, you know, everybody's got one, is that it depends on what you're planting. If you're planting brassicas, turnips, radish, sugar beets, that type of stuff, I would say go ahead and plant it. I like to see that stuff in the ground about mid-August, about 2 weeks ahead of when the cereal grains, I would rather plant them a little bit later than ideal than earlier than ideal. Because if you plant them earlier than ideal and they get good rain and get off to a great start, by the time deer season rolls around, that stuff's going to be 18 inches tall and it's going to lose all its palatability and the deer won't be in it any longer. I would much rather see that plant a little bit late. And even on opening day, if it's not quite that lush green field that you're looking for, a week or 2 weeks into season, it is. And most of us are still hunting a week or 2 weeks into season. So I think a lot of people gear their plots for opening day. And some years it works, some years it don't. You can have your plants too mature and where they lose all palatability. And when they lose palatability, they lose attraction. So cereal grains, I would rather be a little bit late. But if you're going to plant brassicas, something like Plot Topper, then I'd go ahead and plant it now if you got a rain coming.
And let's talk about overseeding a little bit. You know, Plot Topper or cereal grains over your standing corn or your standing beans. One of the mistakes that I see happen every year is folks go in and, like, my beans are up waist high and as thick can be. If those people who've been watching my social media with some drone pictures of the FAE film day with 360 and Novix, everybody was there. My beans are phenomenal. Corn's phenomenal too. But if you try to broadcast in standing green beans that are really, really thick, correct me if I'm wrong, but that seed is going to be down in when it hits the bottom. The humidity underneath the canopy is probably going to make that seed swell and crack, but then with no sunlight, it's going to die. We almost need to wait till we see half of that field turn yellow so that that light is coming down before we're overseeding.
Yeah, I had a young man stop by this afternoon and picked up some plot topper, and he's going to overseed soybeans with it. And I told him not to do it until you see them first yellow leaves on the soybeans. Yeah, that seed, I have never had good luck overseeding into green soybeans. You need to wait till they start turning yellow and then do it. And if your soybeans are super thick, it's still not going to work real well. But
in areas where it's overbrowsed, where your beans didn't get established, where you had accidentally didn't clean your sprayer out, whatever, if you're thin, if you can see dirt, that's a different story. If you plant it on rows like with a corn planter and they just didn't fill out, man, go ahead and overseed. But if your beans are canopied, you really need to wait until those leaves start changing and let that sunlight get down there. You're going to lose all that seed when it cracks.
Yep, absolutely.
So we'll pray for rain. Hopefully we get some to push those bean pods out, finish the corn out, and get all of those folks ready for fall plots to get going. Before the Osseo break, Don, let's both go through our to-do list, our final prep of what we need to do before hunting season.
Well, one of the main things I've got to do, and I do it every year at the same time, is move my cameras, or not all of them, but a lot of them. I shift them from buck summer range locations to where they're going to be in the fall. And I like to shift my cameras before most of the bucks make that shift. So if by doing that, it tells me when individual bucks move into their fall range. And because some of those bucks don't move into their fall range until after October 1st when hunting season opens here in Illinois. And I want to know when he's showing up, because if he doesn't show up till October 10th, I'm not going to hunt him. Once he becomes a target buck down the road, I'm not going to hunt him until October 10th. There's no sense in burning out stands and educating the deer before the one you want shows up. So I'm going to be shifting those cameras to the fall range here within the next 2 weeks, for sure. Fall plots, I don't have much for fall plots anymore with the new ag ground that I've purchased here recently. The farmer that I've got farming that is going to have some of that in winter wheat every year. And so I'm going to have greens through that winter wheat every year on my farm. And that's allowing me to put all of my plots into grains. And so this year, you know, I've got obviously the Generation 2 soybeans, the NutriCrave corn, but also the grain sorghum blend. So I don't have much to do as far as fall plots. However, I am going to overseed those plots with a drone. In fact, I need to get a hold of the gentleman that did it for me last year and get on his list for this fall. So moving the cameras and overseeding those grain plots are the two big things I have left.
I need to make a run to Illinois and hang one Novix tree stand, move a couple cameras. I picked up my Matthews bow from Broken Rack Archery. They paper tuned it. They had to put some change out the shims in it. But it's dialed in. I need to finish sighting it in with broadheads. I know your bow usually comes in September, early October, because you're on the early release date. So you got to also do that. And I'm going to go ahead. Now that I have this mulcher here, there's some thickets that are up behind the barn. While I have that thing on site, I'm going to go. It's nowhere near my sanctuary or where even I hunt. But I'm going to go ahead and do some more mulching here this weekend. So I'm pretty well dialed in on everything else. Just one stand to hang. The climbing stick is actually already in the tree. I could actually hang it the morning that I hunted it. But I want to make sure that the shooting lane's clear in Illinois and then hang a couple cameras. But we're getting really, really close to the season opening. I know we're 2 weeks away here in Kentucky and you're 7 weeks away there in Illinois. So it's going to be just a blink of an eye and it'll be here.
Yeah, I need to find a target buck too. I should have put that at the top of my list. I've got a couple bucks spotted, but they didn't do what I was hoping this year. So I honestly don't know what I'm going to do this season. And boy, back at the 1st of July when I started putting those cameras out, I had high hopes that there'd be a giant on one of them, but they are just getting harder and harder to find. And I'll keep looking, though. I'll figure something out. Yeah. And maybe just a year for management hunts.
Yep. Stay positive and see what happens. You never know. All right. This week's Osseo segment, I'm not going to play the standard commercial. What I'm going to do is encourage everyone to go to the Osseo Gear website or YouTube page. And there is this short film. And the production guys at the Osseo camp did a phenomenal job. This is one of the highest level. This has the production quality of what Steve Shields did with the Mel Hunt. And it basically talks about the first five-year journey that Joe Miles and all of his crew at Osseo did in building this brand. And, yeah, it talks a little bit about the garment. It's not really a sales pitch about, you know, the long tail or the pockets in the right place or the best quality zippers. It's about the people behind it. And you were interviewed as part of the video, Adam Hayes. There were several others in it. If you're looking to understand the people behind the brand, folks, just take a couple minutes and go watch this. We'll leave the link in the description of this video. I hope that you take an opportunity to learn a little bit more about the people, the passion, and the drive behind Osseo. And I really appreciated what you did. You know, every other A-list, you know, kind of hunter that was interviewed in that video kept talking about the camo pattern, the quality of the garment. You did touch on those, but where you circled back about was the people behind it. And it's just so important for us to recognize when we have guys like Joe, who we consider a very, very, very good friend, and watching his brand successful because, man, he's put a lot of hard work into this.
Yeah, and, you know, we talk about it all the time. We like to partner with good people. In fact, that's very important to us. Obviously, the product has got to be high quality, and it's got to work, and it's got to be something that we actually do use. But on top of that, it's got to, there's got to be good people behind the company as well. And Osseo fits that to a T.
Yep. All right. Well, make sure, again, link's going to be in the description. Don and I have both shared this all over our social media. Go to the Osseo YouTube channel and make sure, for those of you listening on MTech that don't have access to the internet, try to get somebody's access to their phone or whatever. We might even tell Joe that we want to play the audio from the film, maybe at the end of the podcast or during the segment next week, for those who can't get access to YouTube. But highly encourage all of you to either watch or listen to the story with Joe Miles about the first 5 years of Osseo. Don, as we go to the second segment, I want to basically just turn you loose, because all of this talk about EHD, we got a question about EHD later in the show. Bucks are being found everywhere right now. I can't tell you how many pictures you and I both got in the last few days of people finding deer, and quite honestly, really close to both of our home farms. It's my good friend Brandon Epperson found a dead deer today that was a target buck. You had folks just, you know, 30, 40 minutes south of you finding dead bucks. And all of this talk about EHD, with you with your windshield time, you really came up with a different perspective that I don't think anyone has talked about. We talked about it a little bit today. I'm just going to turn you loose with this, because I think this might get some head spinning, but I'd really like some interaction in the dialogue down below with the comments. As you go through this, I'd really like to hear what the listeners think on this topic. So EHT and CWD, kick it off here.
Yeah, so I got a question here a couple weeks ago, and I don't remember. It might have been on the podcast. It may have been somebody text me. I don't remember. I get so many questions from so many different ways. I don't remember where this question came in, but it was, you know, why is there so much more EHD in northern states instead of southern states? And I think it was on the podcast, and I talked about how the captive deer breeders in Texas, they tried taking northern deer, bigger bodied northern deer, down to Texas, and they'd never survive because they'd always die of EHD. And then a lot of northern breeders would bring Texas deer up north for EHD resistance, because those deer didn't die in the Midwest or wherever from EHD. They'd just build up resistance over time. I mean, I'm talking probably hundreds of years, maybe even longer than that. But anyway, it just, they've got way more resistance in the south than they do the north, basically because they've dealt with it longer. The deer herd has been exposed to it longer. Well, I started thinking about the whole CWD thing, and for one thing, I'm seeing a shift in people's thinking about CWD, because I remember when CWD started, it was pretty quick that I was probably the first one. I never heard anybody else do this. I started encouraging people not to turn in their deer for CWD testing because of the way that some of the game agencies were handling that. By if they had a positive, they're going into those areas and they're using sharpshooters and corn piles and even, you know, thermal imaging scopes, and they was dragging these deer out into the field at night to these corn piles and then shooting them with sharpshooters. And I had an issue with that from the very beginning. I didn't think that was the way to deal with it. And I was encouraging people not to turn in their deer for CWD testing. And I got absolutely roasted for it all over social media and the internet. Well, today there's a lot of people saying, you know, don't turn your deer in for CWD testing. But I got to thinking about the whole EHD situation and how the southern deer are resistant way more than the northern deer. And I think that whole situation could play out with CWD. I mean, they've already proven that there's a gene that some deer have that makes them resistant to CWD. But when we go in with sharpshooters and we wipe out every single deer, I mean, they're not only killing the deer that are susceptible to CWD, they're killing the ones that might have this gene that makes them resistant. And I think if they would just let it play out over time, Mother Nature is going to correct itself. And it's just like, and I'll just throw in another analogy. Let's look at weeds. When Roundup first came out, Roundup toasted any weed you sprayed it on. But over time, as weeds became exposed to Roundup, they became resistant to Roundup. And I think the whole key to CWD is not these sharpshooters. I think it's letting nature take its course and let these deer herds, let the ones that are super susceptible to CWD, let them die. And the ones that have immunity, let them live and reproduce. And I think over time, Mother Nature will take care of itself just as it did with EHD in the southern states.
Almost like your approach on your fruit trees.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting... It's an interesting spin on it. I don't know that anybody said it like that, but I'm guessing that a lot of people are probably commenting down below that it makes sense, and I'm sure that there's people that have another opinion. I'd like to actually hear both of them. I think most of the listeners to this show, however, do not feel that mass execution is the right answer. And most biologists are even saying that as well. I don't know that anybody has a foolproof theory on what's going to solve it, but killing every deer within a radius just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it especially don't make any sense because they're telling us that this prion lives in the soil for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And if we wipe out every deer, like in Illinois, I think it's when they find a positive case, they shoot every deer within a 2-mile radius of that, wherever that deer was found, for 5 years, and then after 5 years, they just stop and move on. Well, that prion's there for thousands. The same people are telling us that prion's there for thousands of years. That is the most insane thing I ever heard of. This is the government at its finest. And yep. You know what? The best thing that could happen with CWD is if they pulled all federal funding to these states to combat it. If the states had to pay for the bill, it would stop immediately. The nonsense would. I hope Trump is listening. I might just call him when we get done with this podcast, Terry, and I'm going to have a talk with Donald, and I'm going to say CWD funding needs to stop right now.
Call your buddy.
Yeah.
Do you see that he flew a bomber over Putin today?
No, I didn't.
So I guess he met Putin up in Alaska, and he was walking up to meet him, they did this flyover with big stealth bombers and fighter jets real low, right as, it was hilarious.
I'm telling you what, that guy thinks at another level than just about anybody, especially other politicians. I mean, he is three steps ahead of these people. I hope he locks up a bunch of them. Hillary, Obama, Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, I could just go on and on right down the list. All these people that have, used the government to get rich while they destroyed, you know, American lives and also cost them, truly cost American lives in some of these wars, why, if he don't put them in jail, then it's going to happen again. There's got to be repercussions for these actions. I think they all ought to go to Guantanamo Bay, and they'll just be locked in there. And I don't even care if they feed them. Just drop them in there and leave. Leave. Let them eat each other until there's nobody left.
Well, there you go. We haven't had a political rant in a little while, so hope all of you like that
first.
Are getting a little giggling. So let's move on to our Higgins Hot Seat segment, sponsored by 360 Blinds. And in full transparency, we've talked about this topic some in the past, but our podcast and show has grown so much over the last year that we have a lot of new listeners. Don, about 2 weeks ago, we had the summer solstice day, and that was the longest day of the entire year. And I know we could go down a rabbit hole, but I once said in a devotional series that I was doing that the summer solstice was actually the most important day. I think, what was it, July 27th this year, maybe, off the top of my head? I should have had that handy. It was in late July. It was the most important day for deer hunters in the deer woods. And everybody kind of is perplexed by that statement. Can you take a few minutes and just walk through why summer solstice is so pivotal as it relates to what happens throughout, especially November, in the deer woods?
Well, a deer has a pituitary gland in the corner of his eye, and basically that pituitary gland measures daylight, and it triggers different things within the deer, like the shedding of antler velvet. So the days are getting shorter, and it tells that deer to stop antler growth and for those antlers to harden and then to shed that velvet. And then later it triggers the does to come into heat. So, you know, it's really important that the days become shorter for all these different things to happen.
So it's basically the trigger for everything to start for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Photoperiodism is critical in the life cycle of whitetails. And you know what I find amazing is that how can anybody deny the creator? I mean, just think about things like this, and even like something like your eyeball, just one little part of your whole body that allows us to envision the objects in front of us or whatever it is. The idea that two pieces of crud collided with each other and created life is the most ignorant thing I've ever heard of. And I can't even believe that people believe such a thing. But you know that God thought to trigger bucks to get ready for the fall rut, he would put a little gland in the corner of their eye that would measure the daylight hours. And as we got into the fall, as those decreasing daylight hours would trigger different things within a deer to bring on the breeding cycle. And that breeding cycle would be perfectly timed so those fawns, when they're born in the spring, are born at a time that's ideal for their survival. And, you know, how anybody could deny the creator when you really think about, and that's just with one little aspect of the white-tailed deer. When you go and look at all kinds of other things, I just don't see how people can deny the creator.
Yeah. Well, we have some announcements about some appearances where people are going to be able to find us or come see us or listen to us. Before we go to the Midwest Land Group's listener-submitted questions, can you just walk through what's happening here with our schedules here in the next month or so?
Yeah, we got two events. One's at my home church, Solid Rock Chapel in Sullivan, Illinois. It's every year in September. There's a men's retreat. It's a Friday evening and Saturday morning. There is a steak supper on the Friday evening. This year it's on September 12th, 6 p.m., and we got a really, really special speaker this year. His name is Terry Peer. Terry Peer is going to give his testimony on Friday evening. Supper starts at 6 o'clock, ribeye, all the fixings. Then the next morning, there's a big breakfast. And then we're going to do a live Chasing Giants podcast that morning. So hope to see a lot of you there. The location is near the Whitley Creek Recreation Area, which is on Lake Shelbyville. I'm going to give you a phone number to call if you're interested in this. The cost is $35 a person, and that includes both your meals, the Friday evening steak supper and the Saturday morning breakfast. So if you're interested, call Curtis. Curtis's phone number is 217-254-1400. Just tell him you want tickets to that men's retreat. You want to listen to the world famous Terry Peer do his speech. And the other event, I'm going to have to pull up a document here. So the other event is Tag Out. Our friends up at Bremen, Indiana, they've got an event on September 9th. Two speakers. They've got Lee Mitchell. If Lee Mitchell's name sounds a little bit familiar, he is the guy that I said I would put on the Mount Rushmore of deer hunters, along with Bobby Worthington. I said that on a podcast here recently, and I know Lee caught a lot of static from some of his coworkers. Lee Mitchell and Gene Burkholder are going to be the speakers that evening. For details on that, you need to call 574-248-0322.
All right. And we actually have a third one that we didn't tell people. You and I are going to be at the Farm Progress Show.
Yep.
At the end of August, what is that, 26th, 27th, 28th, or 27th, right. 28th, 29th? I think yep. It's 26th through the 28th in, is it Peoria, Illinois?
Decatur, Illinois.
Decatur, sorry. Farm Progress Show. We're going to be in the conservation tent, correct?
Right. Go into conservation tent. There's going to be two booths side by side. There'll be a Green Prairie Seed Company booth, and right next to it be a Real World wildlife products booth. I'll be there all 3 days. Terry will be 2 days, I think, right?
We'll see.
Maybe three.
I'm still trying to get there all three. We're okay. Working the schedule out.
But
if you're at the Farm Progress Show, going around looking at all this equipment, I'm excited to go to the show. I've never been to it. I hear it's one of the best agriculture shows out there. But please stick your head in and say hi to Don and I. We would love to see you. Yeah, I'm really stoked about getting to come up and go to that. So,
well, hopefully we'll see a lot of our listeners there.
All right, well, we'll be right back after a segment from the Midwest Land Group. Make sure you're following those. We got some great, great marketing projects that we're going to be talking about with Midwest Land Group in the near future. I can't wait to tell you all about that. But we'll be right back with our first question in just a bit.
Does your real estate agent know the difference between a rub and a scrape? Or did they ask how many deer you caught this year? At Midwest Land Group, our agents evaluate the land the way serious hunters do, because it's exactly who we are. From surveys, soil types, floodplains and easements, to timber quality, tree stands, access, and food plots. Whether you're interested in buying or selling, work with an agent who speaks your language. Visit MidwestLandGroup.com to connect with one today. Midwest Land Group. Buyers. Sellers. Land. Connected.
All right, our first question comes from Gary Padgett from Canby, Indiana. It says, hi, Don and Terry. My question is for you both on minerals. I have several mineral sites, and it might be overkill. I dump 10 pounds per site each month with cameras on each site. I use Maximizer Plus. The bucks, does, fawns, and other critters hit each site. They spend many hours per day at each site. Is there something I can plant inside instead of using minerals? I do provide high quality food plots all year long. Well, Gary, the mineral supplementation that you're doing is just that. It's supplementation for the deer's diet. And I would definitely encourage anyone to continue to have a very diverse food plot program with as many different plant species as possible. And I'm talking not only things that you plant in your plots, but I'm talking mass-producing trees, browse species, whatever. The more diversity you can offer your deer, the better, simply because each plant is going to have a little bit different nutrient content than the other, and it gives the deer a chance to balance their diet. As for your mineral sites, I don't think at all that it's overkill for 10 pounds a month. In fact, in Ohio, where I own properties with a couple business partners and I'm allowed to do it, we dump out full bags, a 40-pound bag at each location in early spring. And then we'll do it again in early summer to freshen them up. So, you know, we're dumping 80 pounds, 40 at a time, twice a year in each one of our mineral licks. So I don't think 10 pounds a month is overkill at all.
You don't want to know what I do. I gauge it. At different times of the summer, the deer are consuming more than others. And literally, I can look at my cell camera, the way I have it positioned, and I can tell when the mineral's out. And as soon as I see that the mineral is gone on the surface, I replenish it. And I know in July, I dumped another full bag out. You know, in May, I only put a half a bag out. But I go back and fill or refill that. Me personally, I would rather them eat that mineral right off the top and I can see it than them digging down through the dirt more and more and more, even though I know they do. I pour it to it. As much as they want to eat, I make sure that it's there based on, you know, because I'm here on the farm. So it's not like you drive into Ohio. So there's certain times of the year that I'll put out a 40-pound bag, all of it at one time per site. So the thing about if you put too much out, say you go to a mineral site and you pour a 40-pound bag out, it doesn't rot on the ground. Nope. It takes longer for them to eat it, and it leaches into the ground a little bit more. So I don't feel you can put too much, but I think you can put not enough and not get the enough consumption in it when you can.
I totally agree. Better to have too much than not enough. And like you said, a good rain, some of that's going to leach into the soil and they'll eat the dirt, but let them have all they want.
All right. Well, we got another EHD question that coming up here for our second one. I'm interested to see how you answer this.
This one comes from Jessica Balsley from Davisville, West Virginia. It says, "Hey, Don and Terry, my husband and I both enjoy listening to the podcast every week. We are currently experiencing a severe EHD outbreak on our Southeast Ohio farm. If EHD disproportionately affects mature bucks in Southeast Ohio, what ripple effects could this have on genetic diversity and breeding success over the next few years? Could targeted habitat modifications, such as altering water sources, help reduce the risk of future EHD outbreaks in Southeast Ohio deer populations?" Well, as far as reducing the risk, I do think that it can to some degree. But I think there is certain years, certain situations where you're going to have minimal impact. There's just too many water sources and too many possible places where those midge gnats can survive and breed and reproduce and come in contact with deer. So you're going to have a hard time in a lot of areas having a major impact. I'm really interested in this new product, EHD Defense or whatever it is that you put in the water. In fact, the biologist that created that reached out to us, and hopefully we can get him on the podcast for a short interview or something, because from what I've heard, I haven't listened to too much of you know, his speech on his product, but everybody that's heard it tells me it's very interesting. I just haven't had time to tune into it yet and got some real thought-provoking ideas, so maybe we can get that done. But as far as what impact it's going to have on genetics and the breeding opportunities, or however it was worded, is going to be, I hate to say minimal, but here's the thing about genetics, and people miss this all the time. A buck has the very same genetics when he is a button buck fawn that he has when he's a 250-inch 7-year-old buck. His genetics don't change. He's got the same genes, and he is able to sire giant offspring even as a fawn that he can when he's 6-7 years old. Genes do not change. So I think Mark Drury has talked about it in the past, and I think it happened on my farm. After the 2012 outbreak, I lost about 75% of the deer in my area. And I'm gauging that on the number of deer that wintered on my farm that winter, that following winter. And I had about 25% the number I had been having here every winter. So I think it was pretty easy for me to conclude that 75% of them died, mostly from EHD. It just seemed to me that the deer that did survive that major outbreak had stronger genes or something, because It was after that I started really, my bucks just became bigger. And it didn't happen overnight because I lost a lot of deer. But as those deer came back, the younger ones that survived, as they got older, they seemed to be, you know, several inches bigger than the bucks I had had prior to that. And again, I've heard Mark Drury talk about that a couple of years back, that an EHD outbreak, when the deer herd bounces back, it seems like the bucks are bigger. So I can't say for sure that you can look forward to that in Southeast Ohio, but I would not be a bit surprised. Now, one thing I will throw out is there's two places in the Midwest that it seems to me, you know, EHD can break out anywhere, literally anywhere. But it seems to me there's two areas that seem to be getting hit really hard in recent years. And one of those is Southern Iowa and the other one's Southern Ohio. And, you know, we've had plenty of it in Illinois and Missouri and Indiana and other places as well. But those two areas just seem to be get it year after year after year. And not sure why. I wish somebody had a theory on it. You know, I don't know if it's all the cattle ponds. Supposedly stagnant water is way more favorable for these midge gnats than like running water in a stream or a creek or a river. And, you know, both those areas have some gently rolling terrain with a lot of cattle and cattle ponds. So I wonder if there might be some correlation there. But I wish we could figure it out. I don't have a super problem with it on my place. That one year, 2012, was really bad. But I've never really had another outbreak. And to be honest, here's something that's really interesting. I have never, ever found a dead EHD deer on this farm, ever. Now, I know they've died because in 2012, they just weren't here. Where they died, I have no idea. But I didn't even find them like the next spring shed antler hunting. I didn't find the remains of deer that had died the previous summer. So kind of interesting, but I wish we could solve that riddle.
All right. Here's the next question for you.
This one comes from Brett Petty from Muncie, Indiana. Says, this week I watched Don's post about the 6x6x6 buck. I'm 30, and at first I found it hard to relate to passing on a 170-inch, 4.5-year-old buck in hopes he'd make a big jump. But then I remembered you said that was the first really big buck you ever passed. How old were you at the time? Could you share a more detailed breakdown of your progression as a hunter? When did you start passing 150-class bucks, and at what point in your career did you shift towards age rather than just antler size? How much has owning the farm that you own shaped your progression as a hunter? I'd also be interested to hear Terry's perspective. At this stage in Terry's hunting career, would he pass a 170-inch, 4.5-year-old buck? What are both of your goals for this upcoming hunting season? So, the 6x6x6 buck is a buck that I shot in 2012, the year of the drought that I've referenced. And I remember that because I went to Alaska that year. And when I left for Alaska, deer were dying everywhere around us. And I was suspecting that buck would die that year. And also, the drought had just a really strong negative impact on antler growth that year. Lee Mitchell, who I referenced earlier, is a wildlife biologist, and he managed at that point a very large public hunting area, and he'd been running a check station there and detailing, you know, body weights and antler scores, bucks of various ages. And I forget what the figures were, but during the 2012 hunting season, right after that summer drought, the bucks were significantly lighter body weights. I mean, by many, not just a few pounds, but, you know, a lot of pounds. And the gross antler scores of these bucks at various ages were also significantly lower than they'd ever been. So the droughts have a big impact. So I shot the 6x6x6 buck in 2012. I called him 6x6x6 because he was 6 years old and had a 6x6 typical rack. I had passed him as a four-year-old, which would have been in 2010. In 2010, I would have been I'd have been 47 years old. So I was significantly older than what you are today at 30. When I passed my first 150-inch buck, I remember the first 150-inch buck I passed. I can tell you the exact tree I was in when it happened. Thinking back to how old I would have been in my late 30s. But the thing of it is, things have changed a whole lot since I was in my late 30s and today. At the time I passed that deer, I literally did not know another person who had passed a 150-inch buck. It was just about unheard of. Today, there's a lot of guys that have passed 150-inch bucks. So I say all the time that I grew up with the Illinois deer herd. When I was a kid, there was hardly any deer around, at least my area in central Illinois. But, you know, as I grew up, the deer herd kind of grew with me, and it continued until, you know, I was well into adulthood. But, you know, I've just taken one little step at a time as a deer hunter. So when I started, I just wanted to shoot a deer. I didn't care if it was a buck or doe. I just wanted to shoot a deer. And, you know, I got lucky and I shot a two and a half year old nine point buck as my first deer. So then, okay, I've got my first deer out of the way. Then I just wanted to shoot bucks. I didn't care what size, I just wanted to shoot bucks. And so I shot not that many, a handful of bucks. Well, then it was only 8-pointers. They had to be 8 points. And I shot a few 8 points. And what it was is I would wait until I was really proficient at each level. So, you know, when I was hunting any buck, a lot of those first bucks I shot were year and a half old bucks. When I got to the point where I felt like every year I was going to get a chance to kill a buck, well, then I raised it to 8-point bucks. And then when I got to the point where I thought every year I can shoot an 8-point buck, that's easy enough, then I raised it to they had to be Pope and Young minimum 125 inches. And, you know, I was at that stage for several years. And then I raised it from 125 to 140, and I was at that stage for a long time. And then I went from 140 to 150. And the big jump that I really made was back in 2004. I would have been 41 years old, and I'd shot, we have a 2-buck limit here in Illinois, and I'd filled the first buck tag with an 8-point buck that would have probably scored 130 maybe. And that left me my second buck tag. And I, at that point, I'd always been hunting for a certain class of buck. So 140-inch buck. I didn't care what buck it was, just any buck that'd make 140 inches. But I was down to my one buck tag back at the 2004 season. And that's when I seen my first 200-incher that I ended up killing later that year. And I vowed that last tag I had that year was going to be saved for that buck. I seen him, the first day I seen him was November 6th, and I vowed I was going to end the season with that buck tag in my pocket unless I stuck it to that buck's antlers. And I ended up getting it done about a month later on December 1st, but that was the first time I ever targeted one specific buck, and I've been doing it ever since. And I want those bucks to be mature. I want them to be giants too. I want them to be as big as possible. And what I'm looking for is a combination. I want the age and big antlers. And it's easy. I shouldn't say it's easy. It's not near as easy as it used to be. But it's a lot easier to find an old buck than it is a big old buck. And for every big old buck that I'm able to find, I'll find 15 or 20 old bucks that, you know, might maybe score 140, 150, 160 inches. Those giants are just really, really rare. As far as what impact this farm has had on that, it's had a huge impact. I don't hide the fact. I try to be as transparent as possible about everything. I've told people, I mean, I've made it very clear that on one side of my farm, there's an 8-foot fence because I had a bad neighbor shooting small bucks. And what I've learned about, you know, managing a farm, the thing that you got to do is you got to help young bucks survive. Whatever it takes, you got to help your young bucks survive. If you don't, you're never going to have those old ones. So, and you know, I've just tried to be transparent about everything. And having this farm, and I've said before, I think this farm, acre for acre, is probably one of the very best farms in all of North America for deer. And it wasn't always that way, but you know, I've got multiple bucks over 170 inches here every year. And, you know, with this is my 40 year, I think, of deer hunting. And when you've been to the woods 48 years, you got a wall full of good ones. It becomes pretty easy to let bucks go of a certain size because you've already got several of them on the wall. So this farm has been really, really instrumental in helping me raise the bar. It's also made it very difficult for me to find bucks off of the farm that I want to target. And it's only like once every few years that I find a buck off of my farm big enough that I want to go after. Now, I'm running cameras off the farm all the time. I've got lots and lots of bucks I'm keeping an eye on, hoping that they explode and have a big jump in antler growth. But that just doesn't happen very often. So anyway, I just encourage you to continue to raise the bar, but raise it slow. Whatever level you're at, shoot several bucks at that level and get really proficient and good at that level, and then raise the bar. And then it doesn't matter if you're at one level for a decade or more, but get good at that level before you raise the bar. You're just going to set yourself up for frustration.
What was I supposed to answer? I can't remember what he said I was supposed to do.
I think, would you let a
passing
170?
Passing a 170?
4.5-year-old.
Yeah, it depends on where you're at. If I saw a 170 in Kentucky, he's going to have a hole put through it. You know, I'm sitting in a room right now with 15, 16 bucks that are at least 5 years old that go from 135 to 155. And at a certain point in time, I wasn't in an area or had access. So I started going to Illinois. And that's when, you know, you just, like Don just said, you start upping the goal of what it is. But the thing that I keep challenging people is, you know, I get to hang around Don. I get to hunt Don's farm some. You have to have a realistic goal. You can't say I'm in West Pennsylvania and I'm holding out for a 200 every single year. You'll make your life miserable. Your goal needs to be attainable with what you're at. So I have different goals usually in Kentucky than I do here. We have completely revamped my farm. I do not expect there to be a what I would call shooter buck on it. There's going to be a management buck or two that need to be taken and a lot of does. So as far as goals for this year, I got my first picture of a buck I've been looking for in Illinois, and Don's seen it and probably three other people seen it. He's a good one. He would be my biggest archery kill ever. So that's my goal for this year. But will he be on that farm after shift? I don't know. So going up, putting more cameras out, putting another stand up. As far as the first time passing a 170, it would have been the hunting season of 2023. But it was on a property, a deer that I had documented since he was 3. At 4.5, he was over 170. I made the call to pass him, I think, 7 times that year. And 2024 season, we saw him, and he would have been pushing 85 to 90 and died of EHD. So I never got a chance to hunt him, but I don't regret passing him at 170. But I wanted something a little bit bigger, and it was on a property that Don knows very well. It does have some hunting pressure, but it does have a lot of cover, and we took a chance to say, let's let the dice roll. I already had deer in the 170 class on the wall, so I wanted one bigger. But then last year, I shot a 167 4.5-year-old because it was part of the management plan that Don had on his farm. So a lot of it is just what is the plan? Where are you at? What's the farm's goals? What's your goals? There's a lot of factors that come into play, especially with me hunting multiple states. And if I'm not on a target buck, helping Don with his management program on his farm. So I think there's a lot of variables. I think people watch TV hunters on YouTube a lot of times, and they set an unrealistic goal, or they set a goal that's too big of a gap from where they're at now. They want to go from learning basic woodsmanship to saying I'm holding out for a 180 every year. And that becomes a very frustrating sport.
Yeah. And the other thing you got to figure is, there's not an even playing field in the deer hunting world. What I've got access to is probably going to be different than it is going to be different than every single listener of this podcast. Every single deer hunter on the planet has got a different situation and different playing fields. You know, you just got to take things at your own pace and don't try to judge your success or where you're at by somebody else and, you know, how old they were when they passed a certain size of buck. But, you know, I was considerably older than you when I passed my first 150.
So we were both 47 when we passed our first 1-year-old. Because I was 47 when I did it.
That's interesting.
Does that mean I got three? Does that mean I got all these 200s in my future? Is that what that means?
Well, I killed my first 200 when I was, I was 41. I was 41 when I killed my first 200. So how old are you?
Oh, I thought you said you passed your first 170 at 47.
No. What did I do at 147? I've talked too much since I said that 3 minutes ago.
Now you're old enough, they all run together.
I got an excuse, though. My birthday is tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to be 62. I'm a senior citizen.
Happy birthday, Donnie.
Thank you.
Everybody wish Don happy birthday.
Please don't do that.
Let's fill up the comments with happy birthday, Don. All right, let's go.
It could be better than some other things that I've read recently. This one comes from Keith Yoder from Trenton, Kentucky. He says, hello, Don and Terry. Last year, I killed a mature buck on November 16th that appeared to be the dominant buck on our farm. The following days and weeks after I killed him, several new bucks showed up. If a dominant buck is removed, will other bucks on the fringes of the dominant buck's core area move in, or was this simply a coincidence related to that time of year? Thank you for all the information you share. Well, Keith, I heard many years ago that when a dominant buck is shot, right after that's a good time to go in and kill another one because another buck will move in and take his place. Well, I don't buy it. I don't buy it whatsoever because how does a buck know that another buck 2 miles over got killed? I mean, does he read the obituaries in the deer newspaper and says, oh, Tommy got shot last week over here, so I'm going to go over there and I'm going to take his girls. I mean, it doesn't work that way. But here's what I think does happen. I think when the dominant buck gets killed in an area, I think the bucks that are just right below him in the pecking order, they, over a period of a few days, they realize that he's not around anymore. They become bolder and more aggressive with the bully or the dominant buck no longer there. And they start becoming more active and including more active in daylight. And that daylight activity makes them very vulnerable. But I think the buck was there all along. I don't think he's moving in from, you know, some neighboring range. And that wasn't his range. I don't think bucks really change their range that much. I'm not saying never, but I think it's really rare. I think that the bucks you're seeing real active after you kill the dominant buck was already part of their range. They just increase their activity, and especially during daylight, and it makes it, you might not have even known they were there, but they definitely become more visible.
Could it be that those bucks that they think are showing up might be bucks going back to they're just moving through their normal range, but they're staying longer because something's not running them off? You know, like he mentioned November 16th, which was the same day I killed my buck last year. That buck came back to close to his summer range looking in between does. So, you know, you might have bucks coming back through their range and normally they wouldn't stay because, you know, Fred's going to hammer them. Fred's not there. He picks up another hot doe and stays longer with that doe maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it just, there's no way for a buck to know that another buck got killed. I mean,
and you've seen that ranges just don't change.
Pretty much. I mean, there's no absolutes, but for the most part, yeah.
All right. Well, we're right at an hour. We'll save the fifth question for next week. Don, we got a busy week here ahead of us. Hopefully we get that rain, but we're going to be moving all of those trail cameras here really close. We did a ton of work last week filming a ton of content for Chasing Giants TV, and I know I've talked about this here recently. There is going to be some episodes released in the very near future that you're not going to want to miss. There's going to be things coming out of Don's mouth on video that you probably never guessed that he would say. So make sure you're tuned in and subscribe to Chasing Giants TV on YouTube and check those out. But Don, I don't have anything else for today. We'll get off here before you get on another political rant and flag us on YouTube and come back next week with something different.
Hey, I got a couple things before we get off here. First of all, my new hat. Birthday present from my buddy Kyle Birch. Thank you, Kyle. Also, just want to give you guys, share something with you, that this week I pulled up YouTube and there was this video that popped up at the top by Billy Graham. And I'll tell you what, this sermon by Billy Graham had more great quotes in it than I could even count. Literally dozens of great quotes in this sermon. So if you're on YouTube, the name of the sermon is Stop Being Kind to Everyone. It really caught my eye. Stop being kind to everyone.
I could see why you would like that.
And it's by Billy Graham, and I'm telling you, it's worth the listen. It's fairly long. It's over a half hour, but I'm telling you, I listened to the whole thing. Stop Being Kind to Everyone by Billy Graham. Folks, God bless. See you back here next week.
By the way, you got Sunday night prayer time this week, so
I do.
You're on notice. Yeah, you do.
I guess I know what I'm doing tomorrow.
All right, stay tuned after this for Sunday Night Prayer Time with Don Higgins. We'll see you later.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.
Hey, guys, welcome back to the Sunday Night Prayer Time. Special day today. It's my birthday. 62 years old today. And I was looking for a scripture that has to do with age and wisdom. And the one I found to share with you is Job 12:12, where it says, "Is not wisdom found among the aged? Does not long life bring understanding?" And, you know, as I look back on my life, I wish that I would have known when I was much younger what I know today. For several different reasons. One, I would have not made a lot of mistakes that I made in my youth and actually all throughout life. I would be way more successful at a lot of different things, deer hunting being one of them, business another, had I known in my youth what I know today. So I'm going to use this time to share some of the wisdom that I've picked up over the last 62 years. And I'm going to share it as if I was talking to myself, 40, 50 years ago, back when I was a teenager, say. And I know most of you listening to this are not teenagers, but most of you are younger than me. And I'm hoping that something that I share you can use in your life and, just to make things better for you. And when you get 62 years old, hopefully you're looking back and you're glad that you heard something on this prayer time broadcast today. So I came up with five different things or pieces of advice that I'm going to share with you. And number one is to spend more time with your kids and to cherish your family. Looking back at my two daughters and when they were little girls, I was there for them as much as I could be, attended every school function I possibly could, and did a lot with them. But looking back, I could have done more. And that their childhood flies by so fast. You don't realize it when, you've got young kids at home, but, it seems like almost in the blink of an eye, they're gone and out the door and, you can't get those years back. So, I just encourage you to spend as much time as you possibly can with your kids, especially when they're little. But, even when they get up into their teenage years or whatever, the more time that you can spend with them, I promise you, you will never look back and regret the time you spent with your kids, that you would have wished that you did something else. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be just the opposite. You're going to wish you'd spent more time with your kids. You're never going to wish you'd spent less. And really, it goes for your entire family, your spouse, your parents, whatever. Cherish your family while you got them, and just make the most of those years. The next thing I want to talk about is, you can't please everyone. There's some people that you're going to come across in life, you just need to walk away from them. And I've just shared on the Chasing Giants podcast a little bit about a sermon from Billy Graham that I just watched earlier this week that, man, I just can't stop thinking about it. It had so many good quotes in it. But if you want to see that sermon, just go to YouTube and look for Billy Graham's sermon. It's titled Stop Being Kind to Everyone. And again, there were some fantastic quotes throughout that sermon. One I wrote down here I want to share with you. He said, silence may avoid conflict, but it allows darkness to spread unchecked. And, you know, I'm not saying, and he wasn't saying that you should have confrontation with everyone, but there are people that you're going to come across that you just need to walk away from. And he uses several examples of Jesus. He knew he couldn't save everyone. On his journey, he would leave certain places when he wasn't welcome. And I think in my life, as I look back, there's certain people that I wish I would have just walked away from much earlier. And, you know, I've got friends today that I've been friends with since childhood. And I'm not talking about those people. I'm just talking about throughout my adult life, I've come across people and gave them way more time than I should have. And again, that's time that you can't get back. So don't feel like you've got to please everyone. The next thing is have a great work ethic. And I'm telling you, you don't realize the impact that you can have and the doors you can open even with a good work ethic. So, my good friend Dwayne Hopkins has a saying that, you know, every day when you get up, you're writing a page in your resume, and you never know who's watching and what doors it could open for you. And you just do your best every day, whatever it is you're doing. You could be doing the most simple, most mundane job in the entire world, but do it to the best of your ability. And you never know who's going to take notice. And I want to share one example in my own life here recently. There's a local Mexican restaurant that my wife and I eat at a lot. And a lot of times we get this one certain waiter. He's a Hispanic gentleman. I don't know. I'm going to guess he's probably in his 30s. But never have I ever had a better waiter or waitress. This guy is just there. Your glass is never empty. And, you know, every couple minutes he's by to see if he can help you in some way. And it made such a big impact on me that the last time we ate there and had this gentleman as our waiter, when we got ready to leave, I went up to him and handed him a business card. And I told him, I said, if you are ever looking for a job, give me a call. I said, I'm very impressed with your work ethic. You've eaten here several times and you've waited on us several times and you do a fantastic job. I really appreciate your work ethic. If you're ever looking for a job, give me a call. And, you know, with owning Real World Wildlife Products and being a co-owner of Green Prairie Seed as well, if that gentleman ever calls, I will find a place for him. And all because of his work ethic. He wasn't, filling out a resume per se when he waited on my table, but he made such an impact that it opened a door for him if he ever chooses to go through it. So just live every day as if you're writing your resume. Next, I want to talk about the next bit of advice is speak boldly about your values. You know, one thing that frustrates me in this country especially is that we have a lot of people that have great values in their heart. You know, they do what's right. They believe in what's right. But they never speak it. They won't stand up for it. They're silently on the right side of the issues. And I just encourage you to be more bold. I've tried to be that way. I mean, you can't listen to the Chasing Giants podcast very long without hearing me go on a political rant. If you follow me on social media, you're probably going to hear a political rant as well.
on a pretty regular basis, or at least I'll share something that I don't think there's anyone following me that has any doubt about my values and being very conservative. But, you know, it really frustrates me when I know people who share those very same values, but they are totally silent about it. If you really believe in whatever it is, and it really doesn't matter which side of any issue, if you have an opinion, be bold enough to stand up for that opinion and stand up for what's right, because you're setting an example for your kids and for others. So I just encourage you to speak boldly and stand strong on your values. Number five, the very last thing I'm going to share with you is you need to understand in life that the devil is going to attack you. He knows your weakness. He knows how to you know, get under your skin. He wants to, he doesn't want you to be saved. He comes to kill, steal, and destroy, as the Bible tells us. And there's none of us that are immune to it. In fact, I'm probably under attack more now today than I've ever have been in my life. And I think a big reason for that is I am bolder with my faith today than I've ever been in my life. And so he comes after me hard. He knows how to come after me by questioning my integrity, especially in the hunting side of things. And, you know, there's just a saying that I've heard that I think is really fitting. And it is, if Satan isn't bothering you, then you're not bothering him. So whatever you do in life, if you're doing something good, you can plan on Satan stepping forward to try to derail whatever it is you're doing. He wants to discourage you. He doesn't want you to continue to lead souls to Christ or do anything good. And if he's not bothering you, then you're not bothering him. So anyway, 62 years old today. That's my words of wisdom. Hope you can take something from it. Be bold in your faith, guys. And with that, I want to close in prayer. Father God, I just ask you to be with each and every person that's listening to this prayer time. Ask that you have an impact on them, that something that I said here they will take to heart, that they will spend more time with family, that they will have a strong work ethic, that they're set the example of, even if they don't know that others are watching, and even if others are not watching. Lord, I just ask that you give them the strength when the devil does attack them, and give them the courage to stand bold and stand up for their values. Father, I thank you for the opportunity to do this podcast, the Chasing Giants podcast, as well as this Sunday night prayer time. Just ask that you bless each and every one that's listening to this. Keep them and their family safe and guide and direct them in their journey. Ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Be sure to tune in to next week's Chasing Giants.